Support this podcast and keep us going. Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 783. Today we hear from Vega, who asks...
The Everyday Novelist is a podcast that discusses storycraft in the Western tradition. Plot structure, the hero's journey, character development, common themes. These elements come out of the Western tradition of storytelling, beginning with solar mythology and the Epic of Gilgamesh, as you have previously mentioned. But there are other traditions of storytelling, such as from the Near East and the Far East. Do they have any elements in common with Western storytelling, i.e., how universal is the hero's journey and other themes? In what ways does having a Western understanding of storytelling pose a hindrance to understanding texts from other cultures and appreciating their meanings? Or can it be a benefit? Can someone who writes in the Western storytelling tradition learn how to write in another tradition authentically and realistically? What are the challenges in doing this?
All right. Remember when I told all of you about the questions that were sitting on the pile for a long time? This is one of them. Vega actually sent this question in last year, and I've been putting it off because I had to do a lot of study to give it the answer it deserves. I've done just enough reading in the Eastern tradition to have a good sense of what makes the difference between an Eastern and a Western story on a gut level, but being able to articulate it in an intelligible way is a whole other issue. So, in my spare time over the last year, I've been reviewing Eastern stories that I liked and reading little bits of commentary and essays. It turns out that this is a very hard topic to find good information on, at least outside of professional literary studies fields, and I don't know the players right now. So, what you're about to hear is my best stab at this, and I do not claim authority. This is just what I've been able to piece together. So, here we go. There's a bunch of things that make up storytelling and make up the Western and the Eastern tradition, and most of those elements are present in both, but their prioritization and arrangement are different. There are a few elements that truly distinguish them, where there's very little overlap, and so I'll be talking about those. But to start off, the places you would normally look for this are not in the tropes department. Both traditions share almost all of their tropes, and what they didn't share, they have shared since World War II, because after World War II, there's been this incredible cross-cultural mixing. The fact that that cross-cultural mixing worked as well as it did while still basically leaving the nature of Western and Eastern storytelling untouched gives a clue that there's something deeper going on here. So, here's my basic stab. The things that make up Western storytelling at its very central nature and core is their tales of desire. A Western story is about a person who wants something and can't get it. That something could be anything. It could be a good night's sleep. It could be the golden fleece. It could be to get home. But the person wants something and has to overcome obstacles to get it. The Western tradition has a mythic orientation. So does the Eastern tradition. But the mythic orientation of Western storytelling centers on natural cycles and humans acting in opposition to and accordance with those natural cycles. The hero's journey, the coming of age story, the quest story, they all follow a rise and fall that is sympathetic with the cycle of the agricultural season, the day and the night, the life cycle of a human being, the rise and fall of sexual excitement during the sexual act. These are the sort of the breathing, beating heart of the way that Western storytelling works. Its mythic orientation is very, very visceral. And because of that, it's heavy on the conflict, but that viscerality actually comes from a trio of things. The first is its religious orientation. All stories have a religious orientation, meaning a historical religious worldview that has informed the way the culture develops, even into its secular phases. The Western religious orientation is solar mythology and all of its devolving religions. I've covered that in some depth here before, so I'll link to it rather than going over it again, which of course is tied to the agricultural cycle and all that sort of stuff. It's part of the reason for that viscerality. Its moral orientation, which again all stories have, is heroic, meaning that you have a central figure, sometimes a few central figures, but you have a central figure struggling against the dying of the light. There's one person against impossible odds, or a small group of people against impossible odds, and they're seeking to do the impossible in order to save the world. Now, the world they're trying to save could be they're trying to save their kitchen before company gets here, or it could be literally trying to save the universe. But the moral orientation is heroic. The actions of the individual matter to the state of the story world. And because of this, the way that conflict works in the story is that a central conflict is necessary. Western storytelling basically follows Freytag's triangle. That's the five-act story structure, which is introduction, rising action, climax, falling action, and denouement. You can map almost any Western story right onto that, and if it doesn't map completely, it's usually because someone left off the denouement, or they skipped a step, or they blended two of those parts of the structure together in a way that's very difficult to untangle. But you have to have that to have a Western story. Eastern storytelling has all of these same basic characteristic categories that make them up, but what fills the categories, what defines them, are different. In Eastern storytelling, though characterization is often very rich, sometimes richer than it is in Western storytelling, who the character is of secondary importance, because the story isn't about a character's desire. The story is about the disruption of normality. The character could want something, and that's nice, but the character can have no particular desire that's important to the story. Instead, it's the character taking an action in the course of normal life that brings them into contact with the outside world, and particularly with the antagonist, who can be a character or a force, or the nature of a part of reality where they're not supposed to go. And it is the antagonist whose actions and or nature drive the narrative. To crib a bit from one of the essays I read or listened to, and I can't remember whose it was, in a Western story you might have a guy going out to the store to come home and find his family has been murdered by a drug dealer, and the story is about the man getting revenge for the murder. And the reason the drug dealer might have killed the family would be because one of them was in debt to him, or something that they had been up to had provoked the action. The characters are driving that conflict. In an Eastern story, that same plot would have a whole different nature and meaning. The guy going out to the store is not driving the conflict. He's simply providing an opportunity for the dark force to come into the house and murder his family. And the conflict that ensues is the consequence of that transgression. But it's not the story itself. The story itself is the story of the transgression. Which brings us, I'm going to go in a slightly different order, which brings us to the moral orientation of the story. In the Western story, killing this guy, getting revenge, getting justice, and sating the desire for vengeance and justice would be the point. In the Eastern story, the point would be restoring balance in the universe. The local universe has been disrupted. The point of the story is to restore it to equilibrium. So the guy might kill the drug dealer who's just murdered his family, but the point of the killing is not so that the character can have a triumph. It's to restore the sanctity of the community, restore the natural order to the way it should be. It's a subtle distinction, but it's a really important one in the difference. Which brings us to the mythic orientation. the mythic orientation of Eastern storytelling is not heroic. It's folkloric. You find in folklore traditions in the West and the East and in Native American cultures these tales that don't really seem to conform to what we Westerners would think of as a proper story structure. They're amusing anecdotes that illuminate some part of the universe, or that give us an idea of how some part of life works. There's a sense of exploration and discovery about them, but there isn't necessarily a moral thrust. In fact, there frequently isn't a moral thrust in the way that we in the West would expect one. And that's because folklore's purpose is different than what we consider the purpose of fiction. The purpose of fiction is to take us and transport us outside our normal lives, to help us see things from other points of view, to give us a break from what's going on, and to allow us to practice the art of humanity in contexts that aren't readily accessible to us. Vicarious experience, other stuff like that. Now, all these things do happen in Eastern storytelling, but folklore, the purpose of folklore is to transmit an understanding of the world, not an understanding of character. Heroic storytelling's basic function is the practice of agency. It's a virtual reality enactment of agency. The purpose of folklore is the opposite. It's the practice of being in a world that is beyond your control, being in a world that has dark places, and you learn about them through stories like The Big Bad Wolf. If you read Grimm's fairy tales, many Grimm fairy tales do not have a heroic story architecture. They are just tales about bad things happening to often bad people or stupid people, and they don't have what we would consider a full Freytagian arc. They don't necessarily even have real conflict. But they're folklore. That's not their job. The job of folklore is to provide a set of metaphors for understanding what you're seeing in the world, not to provide a set of templates for what to do. Heroic stories are providing templates for what to do. Eastern storytelling is much more folkloric. It's about groups of people who are beset with random adventures despite their characters' desires for stasis and stability, as opposed to characters who, however reluctantly, go out in search of trouble. That's the Western tradition. And part of that comes from the deep basis of the cultures. Western cultures have been basically maritime and agricultural in fairly inhospitable environments since the beginning of Western culture. So Western culture has been expeditionary by necessity since the beginning. Eastern cultures, much more settled for a much longer period of time, much more structured, much more stratified, and while they're agrarian, the sun doesn't shine in the Far East like it does in the West. So there isn't as aggressive a pull on the Eastern consciousness for solar mythology as there is in Western consciousness, and also, the climactic zones in which farming happens in the Far East are very different than the climactic zones in which farming happens in the West. And that the climactic zoning has a major effect on how important solar mythology is to the way story structures work and the way the culture works, and also in what pieces of solar mythology are deemed relevant. Now we get to religious orientation, since we're just talking about solar mythology, where the Western religious orientation of these stories is deeply solar. The religious orientation of Eastern stories are Confucian and Buddhist, depending on the zone. But Confucianism and Buddhism share a lot of deep similarities. And I should note that Indian mythology and storytelling, I'm talking about Indian, not Native American, Indian mythology has a very powerful and interesting mesh mix of the solar and the Confucian and Buddhist traditions, particularly the Buddhist tradition, which makes it its own unique animal that has a foot in each of these worlds, so to speak, and is in a sense the progenitor of each of these worlds. Confucian and Buddhism, where solar mythology seeks salvation through the act of the hero, and by extension, the heroes seek individual salvation through their heroic deeds. The Confucian and Buddhist traditions seek enlightenment through the acceptance of the eternal, unchanging nature of the universe. So instead of attempting to remake the world in your image being a heroic struggle, the true heroism in the East is the willingness to accept that you can't. Now, this doesn't mean that Eastern cultures don't do a tremendous amount of engineering. They do. They had the West beat on engineering all over until the late Industrial Revolution. What it does mean is that the orientation of the individual person, the depth of the cultural zeitgeist when it comes to engineering, is different than it is in the West. Engineering in the East is a corporate activity. The village does it, the country does it, the tribe does it in order to find sustainable peace with the environment around them. In the West, even though you'll see a lot of this in the Enlightenment and the Dark Ages, it actually goes back way further than that, all the way to Mesopotamia. In the West, you have engineering as a heroic act of stealing fire from the gods. There's a pretty simple reason for this. At the base, the environment in Mesopotamia and Western Europe wasn't very friendly. The environment in the places where civilization really took hold and grew fastest and earliest in the East were very friendly. They have bamboo. They have wide open plains and easily navigable rivers that the West doesn't have except in Northern Europe and in Egypt, to a lesser degree in Mesopotamia. But where the East Asians were able to use bamboo, the miracle material, to build buildings, to create pottery, to smelt soft metals, to make charcoal and ceramics to an incredibly high degree. In the West, the technology was based much more directly on stone and metal because there was no wonder material like bamboo. There was wood and stone and metal, and each of those are less versatile, especially in an early Bronze Age context. Each of those are less versatile than bamboo is. It's not till you get to the late Iron Age that you get more versatility coming out of material sciences in the West than was available in the East from the get-go. And so this makes the practice of science and engineering in the West a necessarily heroic activity as opposed to an obvious communal activity, and it shapes all sorts of things about thinking after that. So in Eastern storytelling, that means that conflict is optional. It's not necessary. It's fun, it can happen, but it's not necessary. And instead of Freytag's triangle, they have a story structure that the Japanese call Kisho Tenketsu, which is the whole thing, actually. It's Ki is for introduction, Sho is for development, Ten is for twist. This is where a revelation would be, or killing the bad guy, or winning the quest and whatnot. And Ketsu would be the conclusion, where we see that balance is restored. So it's a four-act structure in which conflict is optional. And finally, in Western storytelling, you have your heroic character, and there may be a team with the heroic character, like Doc Savage's team, where everybody's got a different specialty, and they're better as a unit than they are alone. They fill in each other's deficiencies and that sort of thing. There's a similarity on the surface level between that and what the Japanese call the nakama, which is the main character's team. But that similarity ends at the surface. The team in Western fiction is the Swiss Army knife and the emotional support network and the family aspect of what's going on. The nakama is not a family. The nakama is a civilization in miniature. In a nakama, you have the hero, and then you have his sidekicks. The sidekicks are all so chosen as to represent different pieces of society and to counterbalance the hero. So if the hero is rash, there will be a character who is patient. If the hero is callous, there will be a character who is a deeply empathetic person. And so as a unit, they become a full person. More to the point, as a unit, they become a full civilization. This is really a way of undercutting the individuality of the hero. This is really important in Eastern storytelling because individualism in the Confucian and Buddhist traditions, and especially in like feudal Japan and in China even now, individualism is viewed with deep cultural suspicion. The reasons for this are legion. There's religious, socio-political, historical reasons. But individualism is viewed as necessarily corrosive to the fabric of society. So in a nakama, you have the team standing in for society and counterbalancing the individualism with a sense of corporatism, making a holistic unit that moves together. And in this unit, the main character is the leader. He's the hero or the king, or eventually becomes the hero or the king. Like, for example, one of my favorite animes, Star Blazers, starts off as a kid, but becomes the leader by the end of the first season. You have the king, and then you have usually a group of four or five that are arrayed around the king that personify different aspects of a healthy society. The geek with a lot of useless knowledge, who's nonetheless good to have around even though he doesn't do anything useful. I think the Japanese call him a neat. You got another character who's usually the girl in the crew, who's the emotional heart of the team, who lets everybody else in on the empathetic realities that they're missing. She's the counselor Troy of the group. You usually got a really good problem solver, a really smart guy. And then you have someone else who is wise and contemplative and patient. And all of these people pull against the main character in the same way that a council of leaders would pull against a king, or in the way that the priestly class and the agricultural class and the academics and the metallurgists or tradesmen would all pull against the administration in a functioning, rounded society. And in this way, because the nakama is a microcosm of society, you have this interesting difference between the Eastern nakama story and the hero's journey. The hero's journey is, in the West, is a microcosm of the coming-of-age story, or of the initiation of the hero into a higher state of maturity or of consciousness. It's a story of standing up against the corruption and temptation that society offers. It's often very antisocial in a very basic sense, following the notion expressed, expressed by a philosopher in the late 19th century, or the early 20th century, it might have been Bertrand Russell, said that civilization is invaded every 18 years by a group of violent savages, meaning young men, and its society has to incorporate them. The hero's journey in the West is about the violent savages working against society, becoming incorporated into it, and society changing as a result, being revivified, because the energy of those violent savages gets absorbed into the whole and gives a creative push to the rest of civilization. In the Eastern tradition, the journey of the heroes is a microcosm for society defending itself as a group against attack and disruption from the outside. It doesn't start until there is that initial attack from the outside, or a need that drives the group outside, whether it's to go out to the store or to go conquer some farmland or whatnot. It's a story of corporate survival at the expense of individuals who are dearly missed when they die, but whose death is a sacrificial act and a necessary one for the survival of the group. And the group, by doing this, achieves enlightenment for everybody, as opposed to in the Western tradition where the hero goes out and achieves enlightenment and brings it back to share it with the rest of everybody. So, like I said, this is what I've been able to figure out well enough to articulate, and those of you listening who grew up in the Far East, and I know there's a few of you, please do send in criticisms, because I'm going at this basically de novo. This is my first attempt to really articulate this stuff, and so I may be doing it very poorly, but that is, as best I understand it at the moment, the difference between the Eastern and the Western traditions. Now, as to the rest of your question, you asked, does having a Western understanding of storytelling a hindrance to understanding text from other cultures and appreciating their meanings? It can be. It's rather like watching opera in foreign languages, though, you know, there they at least have the same structure so you can follow along based on your expectations. You have to almost consciously decouple your expectations from what you're finding. There's a degree of openness you have to cultivate to, which is a very Eastern thing, allow it to be what it is and accept it for what it is and then try to figure it out. But at least most people aren't going to figure it out just going into it trying to evaluate it. You have to understand it before you can evaluate it, which may seem a little paradoxical, but I think it's true. Can it be a benefit? Yes, definitely can be a benefit. The cross-fertilization is the essence of creativity. And so the wider your net and the deeper its roots at the points where it contacts the ground, so to speak, in terms of storytelling, mythic background, and general knowledge of whatever, all of that stuff will benefit you as a storyteller. You also ask, can someone who writes in the Western tradition learn how to write in another tradition authentically and realistically? I don't know anyone who does, but that's because I don't read a lot in the kinds of areas where I would run into people like that. Given that there have been a number of Eastern storytellers who have crossed over into the West fairly successfully, I would say yes. You absolutely should be able to. I'm not sure what it will require of you, because I haven't done it. But I see no a priori reason why it shouldn't be possible. What are the challenges in doing this? I don't think I know of any others that I haven't covered already. So I'll leave you there, and boy, this was an epic question. 35 minutes of recording time. We'll see how it comes out in the edit. But thank you for sending it in, Vega, and for your patience in giving me a year to get back to you on it. I'll see you all tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.